the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
From Radio America and the American Veterans Center, this is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators recall and retell their personal stories, serving our nation in times of war. And now, Veterans Chronicles.
In this week's episode of Veterans Chronicles, American Veterans Center President Jim Roberts conducts a follow-up interview with Rufus Phillips, one of the earliest Americans stationed in Vietnam and an expert in counterinsurgency strategy. He is the author of the recently published book, Why Vietnam Matters. Following on his earlier appearance, Phillips tells the story of how he served as an advisor to the CIA, USAID, and the State Department throughout the Vietnam War. The conversation begins with the infamous South Vietnamese Buddhist Revolt of 1963.
Welcome to Veterans Chronicles. I'm your host, Jim Roberts, and my guest, Mr. Phillips. So welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
When you were talking with Dr. Sorley at the end of the last conversation, Mr. Phillips, we had gotten to the period 1963 in South Vietnam, involving the Buddhist revolt against the Diem regime. And by that time, our new ambassador, Henry Cabot Lodge, had arrived on the scene, I believe. Pick up the story there, if you would, please.
Okay. Well, the Buddhist revolt, an uprising, I would call it, continued to grow. And unfortunately, Ambassador Nolting went on home leave. He thought the problem was solved when it wasn't. And by the time he was coming back, the raid was made on all of the Buddhist pagodas and a real crackdown. In the meantime, the administration made the decision to replace him anyway with Henry Cabot Lodge. So Lodge arrived in July, and I didn't know what to expect. We were all kind of wondering where we were going. The first thing I knew, his two assistants came over to see me for breakfast the morning after he arrived. And they said, Lodge needs to know what's going on. He doesn't have confidence in the regular agency or anybody else, and he's heard that you have very good contacts, so can you find out? Well, I knew the Secretary of Defense in Nguyen Dinh Thuan very well. He was really an old friend from 1954-55. And I knew a general, Levon Kim, also extremely well because I had been with him on this operation occupying the area in central Vietnam in 1955. So I went to see both of them, and Kim was very angry because Zim's brother, Nguyen Nu, had misled the army in how they were going to handle the Buddhists, and under the cover of that had used special forces and the special police to raid the pagodas and was giving credit to the army for doing this. And I went to see the Secretary of Defense, and he was really upset. He thought this – he had been working on mediation, and he thought that it could have been solved, but he was really upset. And hold so the whole government. So I reported this to Lodge, and I didn't know it, but he took what I memos I had written for him and sent them directly to Washington. And that aroused a lot of alarm in Washington. So they sent a cable out to Lodge, which had two courses of action: either talk to Jim about trying to get rid of his brother Nu, which was a lot of the source of the problem, or start talking to the generals. And
about replacing Jim.
Yeah, about replacing Jim.
And I think at this point it might be helpful to have you just recap what exactly your duties and responsibilities were at this time.
Well, I certainly wasn't responsible for anything having to do with the Buddhist problem, but I was assistant director in the A mission. And I had conceived of a program where we put people out in the country side, working directly with the province chiefs, decentralized the funding out there, set it up so that decisions were made jointly by the province chief and the USAM representative, which was a considerable derogation of Vietnamese sovereignty. And I'd done this because due to the early relationships, when I came back out to run that program, Jim sort of welcomed me like I was an old friend, and that's how things were back in 54, 55. So I enjoyed an unusual degree of access and trust from the Vietnamese. And the program was very successful, but at the same time, almost inadvertently, of course, I became intimate with what was going on in the palace. I knew Zim's private secretary, who would tell me about his problems, you know, which didn't have much to do directly with my job. Mm-hmm. So I sort of became the guy who knew the most about what was going on,
right,
on the Vietnamese side.
I hope I'm not replowing old ground here, but I would be interested to hear your assessment of President Diem. I think the conventional wisdom is that he was detached from the population. There's an element of corruption and nepotism there. Other accounts by Mark Moyer and others have painted a different picture of him as a real patriot, as someone who was very aesthetic in his personal living habits. A celibate bachelor who really had who slept in a very small bed, had two suits to his name, and really had the best interests of his country at heart. Which Zim was the real one?
Well, I think the real one's probably a combination of all those traits. He did have kind of a reclusive personality, but mm-hmm. he was a really dedicated patriot. And he had ridden in early on a wave of popularity because he stood up to the French. I mean, he was a genuine Vietnamese
right.
nationalist. And people still had a lot of affection for him. His problem was that his family took advantage of his position. And his brother knew, ran the intelligence services and also a secret political party, which was very divisive. And his brother Took was a bishop who just because he had connections with Jim, exceeded his authority and was really responsible for the Buddhist revolt up there because mm-hmm. he flew Catholic flags during Catholic events, but then the Buddhists were repressed from flying their flags during their events. And the law said nobody was supposed to fly private flags like that, only the flag of Vietnam. And so I viewed him as a very tragic figure who was sort of misunderstood by the Americans. He was stubborn. He was hard to talk to if you didn't know him.
Mm-hmm.
So he impressed Americans as a guy who was completely out of connection,
right.
with what was going on. I found him pretty well plugged in, certainly so far as what the provincial governors or province chiefs were doing and all of that. I found him also influenced by his brother's views, who he relied on increasingly. And that really had a bad effect during the Buddhist revolt because his brother took a hard line. And Zim was supplied with information that the deaths up in Hue in the original protest were caused by the communists, not by, poor actions by the local army. And, in fact, it was the local army. It was inadvertent. But so he believed that. And you couldn't shake him on that one. And so instead of his becoming involved directly going up there, which New advised him not to do, the thing was allowed to develop in a vacuum. And in the meantime, the Americans were just pounding on him. And I wanted to bring Lansdale back, and I'll touch on that again when I talk about talking to President Kennedy, because he understood Zim. And I thought that he could be very helpful in trying to help Zim pull himself out of this crisis. So Zim was a mixture of characteristics. He certainly was not a modern, outgoing kind of president. Vietnamese are not traditionally outgoing either. But he did lack, I think, the ability to have a touch for the common Vietnamese. So he was a mixture of people. If you could have gotten rid of his family, the two brothers, I think he would have been okay.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you had to take the whole package. And
how about the nature of the Buddhist crisis itself? I mean, how real was communist involvement in that?
It turns out that if you really examine the reports, the communists were almost not involved at all. And so, and you can see that in the treatment they gave the leaders of that revolt once they took over in 1975. The key guy, they in effect locked up in a monastery. The other guy they killed. So, you know, the notion that somehow the communists were behind the Buddhist revolt was not true. There was just some genuine resentment there. And it was particularly true up in Hue. It was not widespread in the country. But there was just unequal treatment. And the president, I had a very good friend who went up on behalf of the president to mediate things in the Da Nang area in the center. And he did a very terrific job. I mean, he really calmed things down because he was a Buddhist. And he told me that the problems were with Nu and with Bishop Thuc.
Mm-hmm.
They were the ones that were really taking this hard line. And so he said that, for example, he talked to Thuc, and Thuc would refer to the Buddhists in very derogatory terms. But if he talked to Zim's terms, when he talked about the Buddhists, were always correct and never, you know, he never cast aspersions on them. And so, you know, you get a sense that basically the president had, Zim had become more and more isolated.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that when I brought situations to him where we had a corrupt province chief or where there was another province chief that was doing a lot of bad things, he would listen and then action would be taken. So the notion that he was totally out of touch is not correct.
All right. Mr. Phillips, we'll pause now for a brief commercial break and return shortly.
When we return, Rufus Phillips talks about the behind-the-scenes political workings in South Vietnam during the early 1960s.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veteran Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee, and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveterancenter.org. Or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
I'm Jim Roberts, and my guest today is Rufus Phillips, the author of Why Vietnam Matters, an account of lessons not learned. And Mr. Phillips was for 14 years, from 1954 to 1968, a military and civilian advisor to the CIA, USAID, and the State Department on Vietnam, and played a key role during that period in what can only be described as tumultuous events that have had long-lasting consequences. Mr. Phillips, I'd like to now go back to 1963, which I believe is the year that Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge arrived in South Vietnam.
Exactly, and he was our representative to the UN, and, you know, so he carried a lot of prestige.
The Massachusetts family. And,
And Kennedy, in fact, defeated him as senator.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
So it was in many ways that looked like a good choice.
Right. Do you think he was
a good choice? No.
Okay. anticipated my question. Was he well suited for the job?
No, he was not.
Okay. And why not?
The reason is that his approach was a very self-centered, kind of Brahmin patrician one, in which in the first luncheon that I ever had with him, I expected him to ask me a lot of questions about Vietnam, and he talked almost all of the time about how he had been the person who persuaded Eisenhower to run for president and then came back and managed Eisenhower's campaign. And the message was clearly, you know, he knew everything about politics.
Right, right.
And so he knew how to fix this Vietnam problem. And, of course,
he didn't know anything about it at all.
And he didn't understand the Vietnamese at all.
Yeah.
You know, he had a very simplistic view that, well, we just get rid of Diem and Nu and let the generals take over and everything's going to be fine. And so that was his attitude. I did persuade him that he needed Lansdale out there. I had a double motive, frankly. Lodge wanted him to manage the whole coup support idea, you know, that what we were trying to do to coordinate American support underneath the surface for the coup.
Tell us a bit about Lansdale, if you would.
Lansdale was an unusual human being. He had, together with McSisai, who became almost his brother, defeated the Hooks in the Philippines by just turning the Defense Department into a defender of the population, the whole thing. And it was so effective that, you know, he became so popular that he ran for president. He won by a million votes. And, you know, it was just a very unusual human being. Lansdale came out of that experience with a lot of ideas about how to fight guerrilla warfare.
Right, right.
And he came to Vietnam. He'd been in Vietnam briefly on a visit before, and his one conclusion was, this ain't going to work unless the French give the Vietnamese their independence. Well, they hadn't, of course, until after Dien Bien Phu. So I worked for him, and he had a very broad vision about what the Vietnamese needed to do and how we might use our influence to help them. And I remember asking him one day, I said, because I was confused, I was working on getting the Vietnamese army involved in pacification. And so I didn't understand how my piece of what I was doing fitted into the whole. And he said, I said, you know, what are we doing? And he said, Roof, it's simple. He said, think of it this way. He said, we're here to find out what the Vietnamese people want and then help them get it. Now, that sounds simplistic, but if you think about it, it's really a very broad vision of what needs to be done, and essentially in nation building. And so he was a nation building guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, sure, he used covert operations on occasion, but mainly most of what we did was right out in the open and on the surface dealing with the Vietnamese and trying to motivate them and persuade them to do the things that they really want to do for their own country. He was an expert at that.
So it's to Lodge's credit, then, that he was willing to work with him. Right?
Yeah, it was. He sensed that he needed somebody that really understood the local scene. But and that maybe brings me into what happened during this tumultuous meeting with Kennedy in September.
Well, first, let me ask you: Is it your impression then that Ambassador Lodge, from the outset, got the idea that it was better to get rid of Diem?
Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I was very surprised about that, and we were told that these were marching orders from Washington, when in fact they were not.
That was not the case, right?
Not the case,
right?
And so, you know, I had to help my friend Luke Honeen, who was the guy who really became kind of the person in contact with the coup plotters. I had to help him introduce him to some of the army that I knew very well, and he didn't. You know, and then I got out of the whole thing.
But Lodge was actively pushing this idea.
Oh, yeah.
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 Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the reason he wanted Lansdale, and this is important, is he wanted to use Lansdale to replace the then CIA station chief that he didn't trust.
Mm-hmm.
It's a guy named John Richardson. And when he tried that, that's why the whole business of getting Lansdale out there failed. because he ran into all kinds of opposition from the CIA itself on Lansdale going out there as station chief.
As station chief, okay.
Because he wasn't a regular CIA employee. He was a legitimate general in the Air Force.
All right. Mr. Phillips, we need to pause now for a brief commercial break, but we'll be right back.
Coming up, Phillips recalls an important meeting on the subject of Vietnam with President John F. Kennedy.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiadin area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Before the break, Mr. Phillips, you were talking about Ambassador Lodge's posting to Vietnam, his immediately gravitating to the idea that President Diem needed to be replaced by a coup. And representing this as marching orders from Washington, which was not the case. You were involved in a very important meeting in Washington, I believe, with President Kennedy in September of 1963 about Vietnam. Please tell us about that, if you would.
President Kennedy wasn't certain about what he was hearing coming out of Vietnam. So he sent General Krulak from the Defense Department and another fellow from the State Department out there to do a very quick survey, and the object was to decide whether we were winning or not. I mean, how was the war going? They came back, and Kennedy had an NSC meeting to receive their reports. And I happened to be in town because my father was very ill, and so I was called down to that meeting, just sitting in the back row.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told that maybe I might have a chance to talk, but, it wasn't certain.
Right.
Anyway, these two gentlemen gave their reports, and they were so divergence with each other. In other words, you couldn't understand the two. They couldn't be put together. So Kennedy said, "Did you two gentlemen go to the same country?" And at that moment, I was put forward. Kennedy knew who I was. He knew about the program that I was running. And I was introduced by, I've forgotten the guy's name now, who is on the National Security Council. And I had about 15 minutes to explain everything I knew about Vietnam.
Which is a considerable amount of time when you're talking to the President of the United States.
Right? But, it's hard to compress
subject,
everything
right.
I knew in 15 minutes.
Right.
So I started out by describing, a little bit of who I was, what I was doing, and the fact that I knew a lot of the Vietnamese personally, including Diem. And I talked about Nu and his role and suggested that the real problem was Nu and we needed to somehow get rid of Nu. Also, General Krulak said we were winning the war handily down in the Delta. And that was not the case. I'd just been down there where a whole bunch of hamlets had been overrun. So I objected to that very directly in what I had to say. And I remember the whole time I was talking, Secretary McNamara was seated next to Kennedy. He was shaking his head. And I just kept talking. And I wanted to
try. Shaking his head in disagreement.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to give the president as accurate a picture as I could.
Right.
In other words, the fellow who talked from the State Department described it as, Vietnam was already practically lost and down the drain if we didn't get rid of Diem and Nu. And And Krulak was saying, there's no problem. I went out and I talked to all these people, regional advisors, and I talked to a lot of Vietnamese, and, you know, they said, well, there's nothing. We're not worried about a thing. Well, the fact is that a lot of the Army folks never talk politics, of course, with their counterparts. And secondly, you couldn't expect a bunch of Vietnamese officers to tell you what they really thought.
Right.
You know, you're a stranger. They're going to do this in front of their other people. No, it's not going to happen. So he came back with this totally unrealistic view of, you know, how the war is being won. And so I tried to give Kennedy a view of what things were really like in Vietnam. And I focused on trying to get rid of Nu. And at the end of what I said, Mr. President, I got one recommendation, and that is please send General Lansdale back there because he really understands him. He understands the people. And the president took notes, and at the end of it, he said, I want to thank you, particularly for your recommendation about General Lansdale. But then nothing happened.
Nothing happened.
Because the bureaucracy came into play. McNamara didn't like Lansdale because Lansdale was a people guy, and McNamara was a statistics guy. You know, I mean, if you couldn't reduce it to numbers, he didn't want to hear about it.
You paint a pretty unflattering portrait of him, by the way, about Secretary McNamara being all about body counts and numbers and, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there was a famous incident where he called Lansdale down to his office in the Pentagon. He had this chart he'd drawn up to evaluate whether we were winning or not. It was all statistics.
Right.
And Lansdale said, well, you're missing something. What? The X factor. What's the X factor? The X factor is the feelings of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't, that couldn't fit into his calculus, his method of thinking about the war. He was very conventionally minded in terms of how you fought the war. And that was a real problem, you know, that continued on with General Westmoreland in the way we did the war for a long time. And so, you know, that kind of sort of blind view of how you dealt with the thing permeated a large part of Washington.
Is it fair to say that McNamara and Westmoreland were in sync in terms of the approach to the war?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Until later, then McNamara started having real doubts.
Right. So I read that President Kennedy opposed the idea of deposing Diem. Lodge strongly favored it. It happened. How did it happen? He was not only deposed, he was murdered.
Yeah.
So how did that happen?
I think that, Kennedy felt very uneasy about it. But I don't think he
certainly didn't order it.
No, he did not. And he knew that it was probably going to happen. You know, it was kind of out of everybody's hands after a while. Because once you started the generals and they really got themselves organized, you could have stopped it. Lodge could have stopped it. But, you know, it was kind of a train that, as I saw it, we're just running for a huge train wreck.
Well, who started the train, speaking of the South Vietnamese generals?
There was discontent among the generals
mm-hmm.
with the way Diem handled some of them, particularly a couple of the senior generals who could kind of shoved aside because their loyalties were suspect, and that was a product of Nu, basically.
Mm-hmm.
There was discontent there and a feeling that something drastic had to be done after the raid on the pagodas. And so there was an atmosphere there where people were thinking about the only solution here is to change the regime.
Lodge
then, you know, just gave that a push and said, you know, that's what the Americans want, too.
Did he actively work with the generals?
No, he did not. And we didn't do any direct planning with the generals. We had a liaison with the generals that kept us up to date on what they were doing and thinking.
Did he let it be known to the generals that the United States was supportive of getting rid of Diem?
Yeah, and that that we would recognize a new government.
Right. Okay.
And so that was all the encouragement that was really needed. Now, what happened was that supposedly we were going to have a plane on standby to fly Diem out, and nobody specifically said, "Look, if you kill Diem, we're not going to recognize you." Okay. And so that was left in a very indefinite atmosphere. But the plan was that Zim was to be taken out to general headquarters, Zim and Nu, kept in safety, and then flown out of the country. And
and replaced by whom?
Were replaced by the junta of the general.
By junta.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the junta was supposedly going to, you know, take motions to set in place a democratic government. What happened was that Zim, the day of the coup and that night, left the palace and went to a location in Shillong, which is this Chinese part
section
of the city,
in Saigon, right?
And stayed overnight in a Chinese person's house, and then went to this this church down there, a Catholic church. And he called the junta generals, and they thought he was still in the palace, and he agreed to surrender. And so Big Min, who was the general and the main general in charge, went off to the palace and discovered that he wasn't there and became enraged by that. And then they found out that he was actually at the church. And so there was communication there, and he was waiting for them. They sent an armored personnel carrier and some jeeps down to collect him. Somehow the Big Min's bodyguard became part of this. And supposedly it was that bodyguard that killed them under orders from Big Min himself. But it was not a consensus among the generals at all. The consensus among the generals was that he would be taken there, kept safe, and then sent out of the country on a plane.
Is it pretty clear, though, that Big Min gave the order?
That was the testimony of my friend Luke O'Neill, who was most closest to the generals and went out there during the coup. So I think that's probably correct. I didn't know that at the time. Nobody knew that at the time. Lou, of course, said nothing about that until he had to testify under oath in front of an investigative committee in the Congress.
Mm-hmm. What was the reaction in Washington to this development?
Well, some of them who in the State Department who were very wanted to get rid of Zim were very, very happy. But Kennedy was shocked. He turned white and just went out of the room. And afterwards, which had not been released until recently, is in my book, dictated a message on a dictaphone about his concerns, his sorrow about what happened, and his concerns about where were we going out there.
Right.
And then shortly after that, of course, he was assassinated.
Right. excuse me. My impression is that he was angry at Lodge for his role, but declined to do anything to punish him, or remove him from office, or whatever, because of political fears that Lodge might run against
him
for president.
Well, it's very hard, you know. I mean, what would be the rationale for pulling your ambassador out, you know, without exposing the fact that he was promoting a coup? I mean,
right.
You know, I saw Kennedy as being in a real jam.
Yeah.
The only thing that concerns me to this day is why he just didn't overrule the bureaucrats and said, look, I need some guy out there that I can trust, that Vietnamese can trust, and Lodge wants him. So let's send him out there and see if we can get Zim to send Nu out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the irony is that a couple of days, or actually the day of the coup, President Zim talks to Lodge and says, you know, I've thought about all of this, and I'll do whatever the United States wants me to do.
Hmm. So we could have gotten rid of Nu.
He could have gotten rid of Nu, but, you know, it took some persuasion and some, time for Zim to come to that conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we became very impatient with getting on with the war. And after the coup, I talked to the generals because I knew them. And I think they, in turn, even were very regretful about Jim's death and told me, you know, all of what I already knew, which was that there were real problems with the Strategic Hamlet program and down in the Delta, that things, you know, had been allowed to slip very badly. There was corruption under, not on Jim's part, but under New, and New tolerated it because it was a way of raising money for the secret political
right,
party.
Right, right, right.
So it wasn't as if they were, the Jim brothers were enriching themselves. It was not that kind of corruption. But it was still corruption, right. And too many of the province chiefs and some of the generals were also involved in corruption. And so they felt they had to clean up corruption. They wanted to start organizing government. They set up an advisory council of sort of senior politicians. And, you know, they had a plan. But then we got very impatient with them. McNamara came out and said, who's in charge, you know? He had the three top generals there. I want to know who's in charge. You know, he started dealing with them like he dealt with his own Defense Department generals, and they resented it.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing you know, Lodge promotes another coup, and we have General Nguyen Khan come in. And the whole thinking was, well, things are going to be better because we got one guy who's really going to run things, not understanding the political side of Vietnam at all.
Right.
And, of course, that became a disaster, and the Vietnamese body politics started into a spiral.
Right, a downward spiral.
Downward spiral. And so I blame Lodge for a lot of that.
After the break, Phillips concludes his story by recalling the chaos that ensued in the aftermath of the assassination of South Vietnamese President Diem.
A special thanks to you veterans for your service to our country.
The latest official report from Washington said that warships had broken off the action and retreated.
From the Radio America Network.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
So, picking up the story, sir, you mentioned General Lansdale as someone you admired very greatly and had wanted to have posted to Vietnam early on. And Kennedy, President Kennedy, was for this as well, as early as 1963. He did come back in 65, right?
That's right.
And what was the upshot there?
Well, I should go back to 64 just for a minute. He had been retired from the Pentagon. He formed a little circle of people, and we went around talking to people down on the Hill in early 64 to see if we could find somebody who understood this situation, and we came across then-Senator Humphrey. And so when he was elected vice president, he sort of became champion of the idea that there was a political way to deal with the Vietnam problem, which involved sending some people out there, really understood them, and helped them pull themselves together politically.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was really critical to what was going to happen in the long term. And he wrote a memo for President Johnson, but Johnson ignored it, and nothing happened. Then in 65, Johnson sent General Taylor out there.
It
was another disaster.
Another disaster.
Yeah, very bright intellectually.
Yeah, hero of World War II. Right.
Yeah, unsuited for dealing with human beings, basically, and certainly not understanding the Vietnamese at all. So that was a bad year while he was out there until June or July of 65. Then he pulls Lodge back and decides to send him out there. I think, again, it's sort of political cover against the, you know, vis-a-vis the Republic.
Right.
And so Lodge decides this time he would like to have Lansdale out there to help him. And so he calls Lansdale in, and Lansdale says, well, so long as I can have some real freedom of action in terms of the political side of this thing, Lodge says, fine. So he formed a group of a lot of his old associates, and he asked me to go out and help him. I was running a business, international engineering business, full-time, and I couldn't afford to abandon that. It was not something I could sell. So I agreed to go out part-time. So I went out in 65 with this group and help him get set up. And then I'd come back at least once every year that after for an extended period of time. And I was the one who had lots of Vietnamese contacts and sort of helped the team reestablish and become integrated with sort of the Vietnamese side of things. And that was, anyway, what happened was Lodge didn't give Lansdale any political authority.
Mm-hmm.
He was undercut by the regular State Department folks in the State Department, which was now part of. And Lodge still thought of himself as a supreme politician. The guy really understood politics. And so instead, Lansdale was kind of pushed out to the margins. And it was too bad. That's really what happened there.
My impression on Vietnam, just to wrap up in a sense, is that eventually we got it right. We got it right with Ellsworth Bunker as ambassador, with Creighton Abrams, with Bill Colby. By the time Vietnam fell, or by certainly the mid-70s, the majority of the population was under government control, and the country was largely pacified. But it was too late at that point.
Yeah, that's right. And so American opinion had already abandoned the enterprise.
Right.
Well, what worries me now is we have a situation in that sense very similar in Afghanistan. We wasted 8 years out there. We did almost nothing, and much of what we did was wrong. We were fighting the wrong way, the same way Westmoreland did, without understanding the politics and the importance of the political side of the war. So now we find ourselves trying to rectify those mistakes, trying to work with the Afghan government, establish government at the local level. The American public is already disenchanted, saying, well, we've been out there 7 years. Those folks are hopeless. So, it's an eerie parallel.
Right.
And that we didn't learn those lessons about this is a people's war. This is not a conventional war.
Would you sense the lesson has been learned, whether it's too late or not?
Well, I think it's been learned in terms of the U.S. Army and the whole doctrine of counterinsurgency. And I think we, at least on the military side, have had the right guy out there. I don't know about Ambassador Eikenberry, but we need to do what was done in Iraq with General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker, which is work with Karzai, double team him, and try to straighten this thing out on the government side. Because if we don't do that, if we cannot establish a government that's attractive enough for the population to support, we're not going to win. There's no way you can win this kind of conflict without the support of the local people.
My guest today has been Rufus Phillips, the author of Why Vietnam Matters, An Account of Lessons Not Learned.
This has been Veterans Chronicles, produced by Radio America and the American Veterans Center in association with Pelcom Communications.